Los Angeles, early 2000s. An economic crisis and hyperinflation has sent the former United States of America into chaos. The federal government has ceded power to private capitalists, wealthy corporations, and of course, followers of the path of gangsterismo. Hong Kong and Japan alone remain as the only functioning world governments, while the only refuge from the blazing streets may be found in burbclaves and micronations defended by guns for hire and deadly automatons. But a new power is rising. Information magnate, religious fanatic, and philanthropist L. Bob Reif has a plan to return the world to a state of order, not that of the 90s, reminiscent of something older. He will accomplish it with a drug known only as Snow Crash. And amidst all of this, an oblivious young man named Hero Protagonist is delivering a pizza for the mafia, a pizza that is about to be late.
Speak about this nuts, son. Speak about this nuts, son. Speak about this nuts, son.
All right, so yes, welcome to Socialist Shelf. We are back with our regularly scheduled format of giving author bios.
We are blowback. That was a blowback parody, which I kind of straight up stole from Worst of All Possible Worlds, but they stole it from Blowback. Listen to Blowback Podcast. It's good.
You know what? We matched the tool to the task. We matched the tool to the task here at the Socialist Shelf. And yeah, the task indeed is momentous. It's a big world to grasp this week. It is, of course, Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash. And once more, it is a three-man job. So we are very happy to have Kurt Schiller with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Super psyched to be here talking about what was one of my favorite books. I think it still is, but it's certainly become more complicated over the years.
Sure. Yeah, Kurt is editor-in-chief at Blood Knife Magazine. If y'all don't read Blood Knife, y'all need to read Blood Knife. It's awesome. He does work at Podside Picnic. It's a really fun podcast getting into, you know, literature and all kinds of different stuff. A lot of fantastic stuff over there. So highly, highly recommend.
Thank you.
I'll get into that. And he's gonna be a great guest. And he recommended Snow Crash. I hadn't read it before. I know Joss. I think you had read like a little bit of it in high school. But I mean, I've always been aware of this novel, like at the periphery. Like it's like one of those things that even if you don't know it, it's if you're running the circles of sci-fi fantasy at all, it weighs on the kind of in the distance, the sunbeams from it are falling on you. Somewhere.
Yeah. I think its stature has maybe declined a little bit, which is funny because of, I mean, compared to something like Neuromancer. Exactly. Like to me, this is for all its faults, this is the cyberpunk book that comes the closest to, if not capturing what our actual digital half digital world would be like, then certainly capturing a lot of the fucked up weird stuff. Mm-hmm. The weird specificity, like even, you know, in your intro, you mentioned L. Bob Reif stealing like ancient tablets. Yep. And that was literally a thing that the Hobby Lobby like Hobby Lobby did was stealing ancient Sumerian tablets. It's like, how did he do this? And then how did he get so many specific things right and then get a couple of really big things wrong? Like the racism.
Right. It's interesting because it's without like immediately getting too much into it, it gets a lot of literal things wrong, which like I say wrong as if he's not actually trying to predict the future here. But it gets the feeling of a lot of things really right. Even the stuff in it that makes you be cringe a little, I'm like, okay, that vibe exists in certain places.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So he's got this like he's picking up on the vibes. But what are your like? What is your history with this book, Kurt? And why did you think it would be a good thing to talk about? I know you gave me a couple options, and I went with this one. But
yeah, I think the other one that I gave you was The Stars My Destination, which I think you had a good reason for not doing that one. But I will say if anyone likes Snow Crash, you should read that one for a kind of weird, almost version of something kind of like Snow Crash, written like 60 years earlier. But so I think I first read Snow Crash in probably 98 or 99. I think it came out in 92.
92 is what I have written down here.
Which is funny because, you know, I would have been about 15 at the time, maybe 16. And it's funny because at the time the book was like, you know, about 7 years old. And at the time I was like, wow, this kind of older book.
Yeah.
Now, like seven years ago, I have a kid who's seven. I think I first read it in, so at my high school, there were a couple different like summer reading cadres that you could sign up for. And one of them 1 year was a science fiction one. And the books, as I recall them, were Snow Crash, Neuromancer by William Gibson, of course. And then Mindstar Rising by, I think that's Peter F. Hamilton.
Okay.
Not a good book. Really, it's kind of like if, imagine if like Tom Clancy tried to write cyberpunk. It's about like a cool future mercenary guy who has sex and smokes cigarettes and uses cyber lasers and, you know, a cyber rig to hack stuff. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, there may have been one other book, which was, I want to say Bruce Sterling's, I think it was Schismatrix. It was either Schismatrix or Islands in the Net.
Okay.
So kind of like a murderer's row of cyberpunk and then one Peter F. Hamilton.
Well, so, Tom Clancy writing sci-fi sounds a little bit like President is Missing.
Yeah, we're going to do on Podside a Mindstar Rising episode eventually because I had such a strong read. It's like all the superficial stuff about cyberpunk, but just like a very stupid pep. But anyway, it was funny reading. It was funny reading Snow Crash because at the time it felt like it spoke very much to my teenage complaints and ennui and frustration as someone who was like very technical and was constantly angry with people who were less technical and didn't know what the fuck they were doing with the computer.
Yes,
and like,
yes.
So it's the perfect book for if you were, you know, 16 or 17 in the late 90s and liked computer. Right.
You would have been on the street. You would have been in the black, what is it? The Black Sun Club.
Black Yeah. I would have been like way off in the corner, but like I would have been in there. I'd be like, hey, pay attention to me. And then I got my fucking brain fried.
So. Yeah, there you go. Oh man. So yeah, and Joss, you said you had started this in high school and it just didn't click with you back then. What was your history?
I don't know what it was. You know, I mean, I start so many things and then I abandon so many things. That's I'm working on it, but you know, it's something that's stayed with me since high school. I don't know whether I got distracted or whether it just didn't click with me, as you said, or what. I did read up to the first, like, I think like a fifth of the way through the book, basically right after the sword fight. That's really cool, which we'll get into.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And I had, like I said earlier, I was aware of this book. I'd seen it referenced like in online spaces and stuff. I knew a guy on like basically it wasn't really a chat room, but like on a forum that had a Snow Crash themed like sign off that I didn't realize till later was that's what it was. It was a quote from it. I don't remember exactly what, but like, no, I hadn't read it. And I really did. I had a blast reading it as like strange and all over the places it is.
It's a funny book because I think you either need to be smart and well read enough to realize that it is partially satire, or young and stupid enough to not notice and not care and be like, yeah, fucking cool, man. He's got like swords and a motorcycle.
Yeah,
it's like cool. It is a cool book also.
No, it kicks ass. That's the thing. It's like it has moments that like I described it like to a friend. I was trying to describe it. I was like, there's like a Mad Max thing going on. There's kind of a BioShock thing going on. There's obviously a cyberpunk. Like there's a lot going on here. But okay, so let's talk about the author because that'll help us kind of give a window in. We didn't talk about the author last week too much because it was Ben Shapiro. Because we read True Allegiance by Ben Shapiro and it was a nightmare and y'all don't. But Neal Stephenson, we will do him the honor of doing a proper bio, unlike for Ben. Neal Stephenson, gracious.
Ben Stephenson.
No, please don't infect my brain. that book messed me up enough.
The mashup of Ben Stephenson. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Neal Stephenson, born on Halloween, 1959. It's a great start.
Let's go.
Just if you think Neal Stephenson, you think about science, you think about philosophy, linguistics, math. I mean, the guy does a lot of work with Wired magazine, even doing nonfiction and science, because that is a thing he enjoys. And it's because he comes from a family of scientists. He's from Fort Meade, Maryland, lived in Illinois and Iowa as a child. His father taught electrical engineering. His grandfather, on his father's side, taught physics, both at college. His mother was a biochemist, and her father was a biochemist professor at college. He's just completely inundated with this. He studies physics at Boston University and switches over to geography because that lets him use the university computer more. Like, that is basically his entire reason for wanting to switch majors. And he's super into it. He's super into computers. He talks about it himself in like interviews on his website. Graduates in 1981 and during college starts writing his first novel, The Big U, which is published in 1984. This is a satire on intellectualism at a place called American Megaversity. And it's basically just satirizing every part of the college experience. He hates this book. He tried to keep it. He literally fought to keep it out of print, which is very funny. On his website, even, he's like, the only thing I like about this book is the cover. But like, he's the only reason he allowed it back in print is because people were paying so much money for it on eBay in the late 90s, early 2000s. Because he had like got popular, and he said the only bigger crime than people reading this book is people paying that much money to read this book.
It's not a great book. I have read it. It's not great. It has a lot of ideas that he does. It's got a bunch of ideas that pop up in Snow Crash and other later works of his.
American Megaversity sounds like something out of Snow Crash. So like, yeah. You can see it. And then he's got Zodiac, 1988. More of an eco-terrorist type novel. This is one that I had heard of.
Great novel. Great novel.
Yeah, I've heard it's really
interesting,
good.
Interesting politics. It's a little bit, it's kind of like a, it's funny because it's kind of like a liberal approach to eco-terrorism, which is like, do a little bit of eco-terrorism, but don't be like those guys who do a lot of eco-terrorism. Just do like just the right amount. It's like nudge eco-terrorism.
That's funny.
So he's closer to Kim Stanley Robinson than to Michael Crichton on that whole spectrum of,
definitely.
What do we do about climate?
Definitely. Sure.
No, he is. And he is. His most recent novel is about climate, actually. It was 2021, and it was, I want to say it was Termination Shock 2021. So like, he's actually, and I didn't go too much into his super recent stuff, but I did read a recent interview with him talking about climate, and he says he felt like he hasn't focused on it enough in his career, and he wants to, is what he calls the later part of his career, focus more on it. But Snow Crash is when he takes off in 1992. You know his first two novels, they don't really get much circulation. They've got good sales now, like after the fact, but Snow Crash, it takes off, it's huge. It was written as an attempt to salvage efforts from an earlier graphic novel. He had this idea that this was going to be like sort of a web comic or graphic novel, and it kind of fell apart. He actually said he almost spent more time writing code for the proposed website that was good. The graphic novel was going to be on than he did writing this book, because he was just like in it. But he said that allowed the concepts to move around. And like, indeed, reading this book, it's like, wow, any visual format, this would be an incredibly difficult thing to do. I mean, there's a reason it's like had like five failed film adaptations, like attempts at making a film. There's just so much going on, but it was very successful. I mean, it's on Time's list of 100 most influential books since 1923. It's often compared to Neuromancer, like we discussed earlier. Super influential in tech circles. For a while, you had to read it if you were going to work on the Xbox team in any capacity. Like, it was literally a rule for years. It coined the term metaverse. It didn't coin the term avatar, but it did popularize it for a computerized thing. Google Earth, some of the developers listed it as an inspiration. And quite a few like tech guys have said it's been very important to them. Whether or not they kind of got it, I'm not sure. But you've got people like Bill Gates. You've got people like Peter Thiel, Jeff Bezos. All cite this as a very influential book on them. Peter Thiel said that his... fourth book was more influential on him, The Diamond Age, which was afterwards, because Neal Stephenson ends up working with his uncle under the pen name Stephen Burry and writing some political thrillers. And then he wrote Diamond Age about artificial intelligence and nanotech. And I mean, he's written a good bit. Cryptonomicon, 1999, The Baroque Cycle in the early 2000s, which was a trilogy, and now it's 8 books in a lot of ways you buy it. I'm not sure what the deal is with that.
They're very now, big books is what it big. Is to the point okay. that like it's too big. Cryptonomicon and the Baroque Cycle books are each like 900 to 1100 pages long. Gotcha. So I think it's just too big to reasonably print as a paperback, basically.
Understandable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He has Anathem in 2008. The Mongoliad is a collaborative work in 2010. Read Me in 2011. Some Remarks and Essay and Other Essays and Other Writings in 2012. He's got a book called Savenis in 2015, The Rise and Fall of Dodo in 2017, Fall or Dodge in Hell in 2011, Termination Shock in 2021. I just realized I got out of order there, but that is what I was saying. The last one's about climate, and in Wired magazine, he writes a good amount about climate now. He talks about geoengineering, which he's interested in, and yet he is satirizing geoengineering in Termination Shock, which that's important to know that he has trouble, I think, really, really believing in things without like having to kind of put forth a sort of some irony or some cynicism mm-hmm. or some whatever, which like I guess makes him just an early adopter of the internet.
I mean, webcomic format, like the initial webcomic format attempt certainly makes sense in that context because it's got a really early shot at that like early 2000s webcomic humor, just like total irreverence with any all of the subject matter, regardless of what it's trying to advance.
Right. He's also, you know, politically, because I like looked into his interviews about politics and his politics are like he describes himself as quote left-ish. That's his that's what he says. That's kind of what I guessed. He says he's influenced by Walter Wink's concept of power, which basically I looked into that. And Walter Wink's concept of power is basically power dogmatism, the idea that it's just like absolute power corrupts absolutely, that kind of concept. He says, and there's a whole interview where you've got Stevenson saying like, no matter what belief, no matter what project, whatever, if it's too powerful, it will be corrupted. He says you can have everything from fascism to people owning the means of production, his quote, not mine. And it will always be corrupted if it becomes too strong, because that's how power works. I fundamentally, you know, disagree. I don't know but like that is where he's coming at from. And I do understand, and there is like obviously an element to power being corruptive, but he kind of has this sort of horseshoe theory way of looking at it, I think.
I would describe him as kind of a left libertarian technocrat.
Yeah.
Almost. Mm-hmm. Like he's not a socialist.
No,
I think
not at all.
That I think that his bit, but like I don't think he's not quite like a reactionary either. He's like a benign version of the modern tech bro, where they're not quite so callous, but I do think he has a real naivete to his politics. Like I think what you were talking about power, I think. And this is something that comes up a lot with cyberpunk is like, is cyberpunk necessarily anti-capitalist? And I would say no. I would say it's mm-hmm. anti-corporate, and I would say it's anti-bureaucratic. And I think I think that's his big hang up is bureaucracy.
In every form.
Yeah. Big systems are bad because they're stupid and because they don't work well. But it's a fundamentally technocratic approach where it's like, well, the smart people should be in charge. Whatever system allows the smart people to be in charge, and also like smart and like kind of good. It's very pre-Obama or like Obama era.
Yeah, you know, me and Joss were kind of discussing this over text, and we try not to talk too much about the books ahead of time, but we did talk about this concept of like every character in this, and we'll get into the characters. Are like, well, not every character, but the characters tend to be very competent, and they tend to be, on average, a more decent person than the people around them. They can have a sort of a chip on their shoulder. They can whatever. It's like it's not like Randian in the sense of like it's sense of like they're the dominant whatever. They're crushing everyone in their path. It's like they are the dominant. They are the like alpha in every situation, as maybe you would put it. Obviously, that term has its connotations, but you know what I'm saying. But like they also will stop to help the injured dog or like help the dude who's a refugee, like get onto a raft. And that goodness, though, is part of their greatness. though.
Yeah, they have a capacity indeed for imposing their will on the world through their various niches.
But it's not a bad thing when they impose
their
will.
Top of which they've risen to, right? Well, and you know, notably, one of the villains is driven essentially by personal vengeance. You know, so it's, you know, as you said, Jacob, earlier, it's, you could kind of read it as like compassionate Randian in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think this is early for this, and we can dig more fully later. But
yeah,
I think that exact worldview is part of why it's aged in a funny way, and part of why that list of people who said it's inspired them has a real murderer's row of kind of eyebrow raising people like Peter Thiel. And the problem is, it's written from a point of view when the nerds aren't in charge, and there's a like an underlying idea is like, well, if the competent nerds are in charge, then things will be good. And the book really has no answer to, well, what if the nerds are in charge and they're actually bad?
No, you just put like the genius programmer guy in charge of Twitter,
and then it's
everything
fine.
Will be fine. Like, he's definitely a genius programmer because he says he is, and he has money. And yeah, no one check how that went.
I bet he hates Elon Musk specifically.
He probably does.
I bet he hates him though because he's a bad programmer.
Oh man, because he is famously does not know anything about. I mean, yeah, famously doesn't know shit. But
what is that
absolutely.
One tweet about? Like, you know, I used to think Elon Musk was knowledgeable about cars and rocketry, and then he started opening his mouth and saying like the stupidest shit about programming. So I realized, you know, not to listen to him about cars or rocketry.
Okay, to be fair, Elon Musk, what he names his kids do sound like characters out of Snow Crash, Techno Mechanicus, and like Archangel and stuff, but maybe not in the way he's thinking. But to talk just a little bit more about Stevenson, I mean, we're going to talk about him a lot, but about his life. He now lives in Seattle, I believe. He's resided there for some time. And he's done stuff outside of writing. Like I say, he's written for Wired, but he worked at Blue Origins from 1999 to 2006. That's Jeff Bezos's space project. He was a kind of a concepts guy, a math guy for them. He said he did everything from like helping with wiring to like big ideas. He left there. He was at Intellectual Ventures from 2007 to 2010. Kind of a think tank tech place where he said he, quote, investigated ideas from geoengineering to food, end quote. He tried to start something called the Fortnite Bureau in the early 2010s. Dadgummit, Joss, I knew you would laugh at that. Not based on the video game Fortnite, to support hackers and geeks for getting work in collaborative projects. He said he realized the hackers and geeks didn't need his help to get work and do collaborative projects. He worked, this is the first time I ever heard of Neal Stephenson. The game Clang.
I was wondering if that was going to come up. Oh, yes.
It was piloted, Joss, do you remember Clang?
I haven't heard of it. This is the first time I've heard of it.
Oh, you're in.
Not at all.
Oh, man.
Not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, so what was that, like 2006 or something?
2012, actually.
Oh, really? That's much later than I thought. Wow.
Yeah. It's Clang, and it's Clang all caps. Clang is what it's called. A realistic sword fighting game. He starts a Kickstarter and raises over $500,000, raises an unclear amount of money past that just off his website. And they keep like losing funds. Investors get really mad. He gets threatened with a class action lawsuit because there's just no game. And he admits in 2014 that he worked so hard to make Clang historically accurate that he didn't make it fun, and the game just fell apart. And it was like, in certain circles in like 2013 online, it was like the most hyped thing. Like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever made. This guy is going to do metaverse in real life or whatever. And then people got their first taste of the metaverse isn't real.
Do you remember I remember that most for a really cool like launch video that he made.
I remember it being cool. It might look lame now, but
it kind of has that style of. Do you remember the early like Dollar Shave Club commercials where it was following like a cool guy as he walks around a warehouse and all sorts of stuff? It was kind of like that, but it was Neal Stephenson. What, you know, kind of a cool guy, I'll say. You know, walking through like a warehouse with all these different people fighting with different weapons in the background. Like, as I recall, there was like somebody in like, you know, plate armor and you know, they were fighting with like a claymore, and there was somebody with a katana and so on and so forth. But as you say, no game ever ever really materialized.
No, he admitted in interviews that the game, like, what they had sucked. He said it just wasn't fun.
And it's unfortunate, you know, because it's a case of certainly the vision just not having the tools and the structure to really manifest. Because, you know, reading Snow Crash, you can tell this is a guy who really likes his sword fighting, you know, pays very much attention to what makes, you know, various katana forms work. Like, he's very particular about, you know, the strokes, the wrist movements, you know, how, he would really like the samurai exhibit at the High Museum.
Mm-hmm. Well, for what it's worth, everything I'm seeing online indicates people did get their money back. So that's something. Took him a couple years, but you know. Then he worked as chief futurist for an augmented reality company called Magic Leap. And y'all might have heard of them. They do some of the goggles that you put on and then you see stuff projected in front of you. They don't do the Oculus. They do like augmented reality. So like they project like a screen onto your table that you can type onto. Their stuff kind of sucks that I've used, to be perfectly honest. But he worked as like a chief futurist for them. He got laid off in 2020. And now he runs a thing called Lamina One, which there's not a lot of information on aside from their website. But I went to their website and I don't know that I'm going to be honest, it's an awful website.
Is this the blockchain one?
Yeah, Jesus it's Christ. Bad. It's like when you pull it up, like you get flashed with like a bunch of videos of like, and when you try and scroll down, the video blows up and says enter the open metaverse. And like, it hits you with like all kinds of stuff. And it like, it's hard to read what it actually is about because it keeps like flashing things in and out. It's a very ugly site. But the idea is, and this is a, says that it's, they make blockchain on which to found new metaverses. Baffling, kind of gaudy, but to his credit, he did say on there that they have given up on the idea of goggles because that's not how the metaverse is going to work. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad he caught that one because that the goggles thing is not happening, I don't think.
There's one thing that I see references to appearing and disappearing, which is interesting. And there was an attempt in the mid-90s to basically make the street from Snow Crash as an actual thing. And it might have been that one that's called like Active Worlds. It was like an early, you know, massively multiplayer social experience. And I believe he it was originally like a licensed thing where it was like the street like Snow Crash. And then they kind of dropped it at some. So I don't know if he was just involved in that from like a licensing thing, but like it's this funny thing about him where William Gibson has never tried to bring his cyberpunk worlds into existence. And Stevenson is like, well, it sucks, but it also would be cool to have the streets. So let's see if we can make that and have some sword fights.
Right. Well, that's like, the interesting thing about Stevenson is that a lot of, you know, as we'll get into, a lot of what he dreams up here has been developed kind of in parallel, like independently of him, you know, like we have Second Life, we have VR chat, you know. We have the concept of, you know, walking around with an avatar that can be whatever you want is there. And indeed, I think even predates Snow Crash a little bit. But again, independently of him.
I've actually written an entire article about the concept of cyberspace, which I believe is called Nowhere Here. And that is on Blood Knife. And you're right. It significantly predates it, actually, arguably back to like the late 60s, early 70s, and in a more developed form in like the mid to late 80s is really when it starts, you know, really, really popping off.
Yeah, absolutely. But the term metaverse does come from this book, as far as I can tell, which is interesting. It's a weird context given like where we are right now with like we have Meta, and like we saw the sort of Zuckerberg metaverse, at least their first big attempt at it, kind of make a mockery of itself, lose a lot of money. I'm not dismissing that there will ever be, you know, metaverse. I think as far as I can tell, it seems like there's more likely to be metaverses, like plural, and like and those are expressed more so in like sanction off like little communities and this and that and video games and like you said like MMOs and things like that. Though the idea of like one metaverse that we are all on collectively feels pretty far away, to at least from where I'm sitting right now. Not just technologically, but also just like thinking about it feasibly, like even if it was made, how many people are going to be doing it, what's that going to look like? I'm not sure. But
like, yeah. Jacob, it's funny that you mention siloed off enclaves, like a whole multiplicity of those, because that's kind of what the book's about.
That's true. That's true. And sometimes you have to deliver pizza from enclave to enclave. It's very important. And this was that's where the book opens up. And it's very funny because as someone who delivered pizza for Domino's and Pizza Hut, neither Domino's nor Pizza Hut has a 30-minute guarantee or your food free. But everyone thinks Domino's and Pizza Hut has a 30 minutes or your food is free guarantee. And so this book opening up with like, he's got to deliver the food in 30 minutes or not only will it be free, but like it'll be an international incident. is hilarious.
Uncle Enzo will need to publicly apologize.
Yes. Uncle Enzo fucking rules.
Uncle Enzo is great. He is my favorite character.
Goes so hard. And I'm like, I don't know if either of y'all have played the Bayonetta games, but I'm imagining Enzo from Bayonetta, which like, is not how Uncle Enzo should look. But like, if you don't know what I'm talking about, you can look him up. But it's like, I can't get that out of my head. It's very funny. Yeah. So this book opens up because it's set in this world that I described it at the top kind of like, I mean, like as a joke, but that is how it's set up. It is sometime in the early 2000s, maybe 2010s, unclear. And they're in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is not run by the U.S. government anymore. The U.S. government is it's not small as in it doesn't have any power, but it is this sort of retreated thing. And small micronations and companies run everything, and the mafia is now legal because nothing is illegal, and the mafia owns all the pizza, and this dude is delivering pizza, and his name is Hero Protagonist, and that is that got a chuckle out of me. I know I saw some people online, they were like, I did see a guy online,
they really dislike some people too.
Yeah, he was really mad about it, and I was like, you know, it's a joke, right? Like, but anyway,
now here's something worth mentioning. The first time I read this, I thought it was pronounced Hyro, and so I had no idea that was the pun. I got obviously the protagonist part of the pun, but I didn't get the much more obvious part of it. So, so you have to be like, you know, imagine 16-year-old me going like, oh yeah, I understand this pun, while actually not doing so. I did once. So there is enough information in the book to figure out the exact year, and I want to say it's like it's like between 1999 and 2004, because there's references there's references to Hero's father being in World War II, and I think I think he witnesses
the Nagasaki.
Yes. So you have that, and then there's a few references to like how old Hero is and how old his parents were when he was born. So you can
and you also have Raven retro. in a similar yes. dynamic. And you also, and I mean, I know we're throwing out names right now that the audience may or may not know, but also like you have and you also have the fact that it refers to things like the Soviet Union doesn't seem to have fallen all that long ago. It feels very recent in this book. I guess it is still recent on historical terms now, but like in this book, it still feels very like it just happened and things like that, because of some of like the references to things. So I would definitely say like my guess was around like somewhere between 2000 and 2004.
It would have formally collapsed like right before it got published.
Right.
Because exactly. The so book it was came like out in 92, thing. So he probably wrote it having not happened yet, honestly.
Right. It was like a live thing. And it is interesting, like, you know, so that there is like that speculation there. And it is always interesting to read a book that takes place before it, that was the future for the people who wrote it, and is now the past. And of course, this book is not, you know, as we've said with a lot of things that we've talked about speculative fiction, with very few exceptions, this book is not meant to be like Neal Stephenson, like, I think things are going to be just like this. This book is half, I'd say like half parody. There's like, there's concepts that I think he thinks is cool and maybe could happen, and some stuff that could not happen. And half the time it's kind of joking. Like there's like a Mad Max feel to all of it that like, it kind of kicks ass in parts, but it's also like, are you making fun of this? Are you not? And the answer is kind of yes. There's a lot of book in this book. There's just a lot happening in this world.
I would compare it to like a Paul Verhoeven type
type
feel, where it's RoboCop. Like, it's kind of, yeah, exactly. It's like, well, RoboCop is a satire of action movies. It is also a kick-ass action movie.
Yeah,
it's like, it's kind of like having its cake and eating it and chopping it up too with a sword. Mm.
Yeah, just with a katana, which is what Hiro has on his back while he delivers pizza. And unfortunately, due to a mix-up and the fact that that the pizza he was handed was like 20 something minutes old, the dude gets in a car wreck and gets helped by a young courier. And Joss, you want to explain the concept of a courier? I kind of like to say courier to make it sound more like, I don't know. I know it's courier, but with a K.
Yeah, courier. Yeah, courier with a K. And the person in question is a 15-year-old girl named YT, for yours truly. Described by the, if you highlight it on Amazon Kindle, you know, this sort of smart notes will describe her as like the real protagonist of the book, with which I tend to agree, because a lot of what happens is driven forward by the missions that she runs. How couriers basically work in this world is Yeah, you're on a skateboard, like a smart skateboard with like not just wheels, but like the wheels are these basically like smart, like koosh balls, essentially, that account for all kinds of momentum, surfaces, whatnot. And you get around with like these harpoons with which you just like latch onto cars magnetically. And you're just looking for the fastest one that's going in the direction that that you need to go. And she crosses paths with Hiro when he crashes in this empty swimming pool trying to deliver this 20-minute-old pizza that he's been handed. And she strikes a deal with him to deliver the pizza. And
because Google Maps was out of date, effectively. Yes. Or, you know, his version of Google Maps.
Yeah. And it's like also... I will say, like, the couriers thing, like, I'm like, it's interesting that there's no like real tie-in media with this. That's not like fan made, like there's not a sequel, there's not whatever, but like if there was going to be some kind of tie-in, a courier video game would kind of whip ass. Like that would
makes me think of like Jet Set Radio Future, sort of, sure, something along those lines.
It's cool. Like the concept is very cool. And we get right back. We get into with the courier Stevenson's concept of like what a free individual is in the society that is like ours in a lot of ways, but just more so, right? Everything dialed up to 11, the divisions dialed up to 11, to the point of everybody's got their own little micro nations that are, you know, the company's corporate power dialed up to 11, all of that. We're just gonna now formalize corruption instead of just allowing it. And in this society, the free people in a lot of ways, and not that they're not at the whims of like powered interests, but are these people that can zip between burbclaves, zip between these micronations, who can flaunt the offices literally by like skating over desks. I mean, like in the, there is, you know, an element of parody to this, like the cool kid in like an 80s movie, but also like I think that there is something real in Stevenson's mind about like these are like the free people, the free spirits, the wanderers, the whatever, the people who are not tied down. And YT even has a moment later in the book where she's working a job and she's like, oh wait, most people just do this all day, holy shit, this sucks. I think that's kind of central to like Stevenson's idea.
And there's this weird sense of, you know, yes, you, it really nails it really nails this sort of ineffable pride of being in this dead end job, but being really, really good at it, you know, just like the top of your, you know, the top of this particular working class niche. And I mean, you know, literally like it's, the book starts out from the perspective of Hiro, third person perspective, and he's talking about himself as, you know, the deliverator, right? You know, belongs to an elite order, a hallowed subcategory, you know, carrying out a mission, you know, uniform black is activated charcoal, bulletproof, all that, you know, it's got that element of bathos, you know, of treating this, of treating a, you know, pizza delivery guy as essentially this this all, you know, this really cool courier. It's got that, but with, and with that sense of, with that sense of freedom, with that sense of power that being at the top of your working class game, gives you, it's counterposed with being in hock to the mafia, like for life, if you fuck up once. Right. But also, you know, if you plow through a neighborhood or two, you know, you have the mafia in your corner if somebody gets pissy about it, because, you know, what are they going to do against a globe spanning pizza delivery corporation who has a business to run, right?
It's and it makes for like a very fun, like crazy high adrenaline dynamic. And the whole time, I mean, it's throwing out jokes and descriptions and light and color and this and that. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, like, he'll even just be like zipping through the neighborhood and it'll just say, children ran outside. Some children ran outside. Children's pajamas can be flameproof or non-carcinogenic, but not both. Like, it just like, no, for no particular reason. The beginning of the book opens describing him as the deliverator, and it doesn't. And it just, like, later on, he's not. And, like, you think pizza delivery is going to be the center of the novel, and it's not. It just, he's just doing, he's throwing a lot at you, and it makes for a wild experience.
I believe it's not really quite said overtly, but I think we're meant to understand that he got fired for like destroying the car, even though like he didn't get in trouble. Like he got the pizza there, and so they kind of like called it even. But they're like, okay, but you're not doing this anymore.
I think he just didn't go back to work. I think it was a situation like, I'm not going to get fired if I don't go back. You know?
I think the next time we see him, he's like living in like a storage container outside the airport. With his like weird roommate Vitaly.
Yeah, there's a whole society. There's a whole society that like just of people who just live in storage containers. Like you store it basically, and he's just in there. But like in the real world, I mean, like it's the meme. Like I may be a loser in real life, but in the gaming world, you're the loser. Like that kind of thing. That's literally Hero's life. Like he doesn't have much going for him, at least not right now. But like in the gaming world, in the metaverse. He's the coolest guy around. Though and it is interesting though to the dynamic of it, like draws a distinction. So in the real world, quote unquote, in the physical world, there is some, you know, 9 billion people, and most of them cannot afford access to the internet. Off the bat, most people are living in zones where it's just like, okay, there's just nothing here. Basically, they've got zones where they're like, no, the cost of investing in this wouldn't be worth it. Most people in the world, it says, are just doing bullshit jobs or, you know, fighting each other or scrounging through the trash. You've got about 1 billion people, it says, who have access to computers. And of that, a fraction of them, you know, can know how to use the metaverse. Now, it's notable that Hero is not a person who has enough money and enough resources to be in these suburbs, these like burbclaves. But he is able to have this like community, this like faux community in the metaverse. It's notable to me that the people in these suburbs or whatever are able to create their own like little fake communities there. And they're like not a whole lot more real than the metaverse. I mean, you have like New South Africa, which is basically just post-apartheid people who've made white South Africa as like as a franchise, which is fucking insane. You've got Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Yes. I don't know. What did y'all think about the suburbs?
I think just the fact that we see suburbs in a cyberpunk book is very novel.
No doubt.
Then and now. Like, it is very much, you know, it's not normally what people mean when they say urban literature, but it is, you know, cyberpunk tends to be literature of the city or literature of, you know, huge gatherings of people. And I think that immediately Stevenson is drawing this very arrogant, but not like completely understandable. It's not quite arrogant, it's more like conceited view of like, well, there's us, you the reader, me, you know, all the other smart people who know how to use computers, and then there's the consumers, you know, spelled OOMERS, you know, who live in the suburbs. And it's kind of like, well, he's a smart person moving through a fundamentally stupid world. And I think it's interesting because one of the big things that I think Snow Crash was ultimately one of the first cyberpunk books to grapple with is the fact that, like, okay, yeah, in 1992, the people who used computers, well, you know, I mean, they weren't like cool, but they had a certain intellectual cachet, you know, like you could imagine yourself being Hero or being Case from Neuromancer. And I think Stevenson very perceptively realizes, oh, well, the internet is eventually all these other people who aren't like that and don't know or care how computers work are going to get on the internet too. And we're going to have to coexist with them. And it has just a real derision for their whole way of life. Like there's stuff about this very 90s stuff about like minivans, which Stephen calls bimbo boxes.
Yeah.
there's stuff about, you know, like plastic white picket fences. It's like the whole idea of the burb clave is it's just like a satire of the suburbs, but like dialed up to, you know, to like 11. Like, okay, well, instead of there being, you know, a suburb that is like low-key racist, which I would say is most suburbs, there's one that's just like in your face, like, yes, New South Africa. You know, that's our thing.
Yeah, and it says the only reason they leave it is just to like do hate crimes, like later in the book. Like you have like Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, which is basically like a micronation that's like, you know, defended by this high tech thing. It's mostly you know, it's mostly people from Asia who've come over there.
Notably, Hero is not white. I believe his father is black and his mother was Japanese, I think.
He's half, I believe he's half black, half South Korean.
I think
it's a Korean. Yeah, was what it said. But that actually is kind of important, especially like with some of the interactions he ends
up mentions
having.
That like he can't go into New South Africa. He's not allowed to go. He's not allowed to like make deliveries in there, basically.
Right. And I mean, later in the book, literally just gets harassed by some people from New South Africa, which is like notably not just like one place, but a franchise, because like they've just managed to. I mean, like there's a part in it, and I'll quote it a little later, that they've turned everything into McDonald's. In fact, honestly, it makes sense to just go ahead and quote it now. I've got it written down, but basically the concept is there's like the meme online of posting that like one picture of an interstate in the United States with like, y'all know the picture with all the gas stations and the idea of like everything has been like homogenized into that. Right. And I like this quote because it kind of gets at it in a more interesting way. It says, quote, "The concept of the franchise and the virus work on the same principle. What thrives in one place will thrive in another. You just have to find a sufficiently virulent business plan, condense it into a three-ring binder, its DNA, Xerox it, and embed it in the fertile lining of a well-traveled highway, preferably one with a left-turn lane. Then the growth will expand until it runs up against its property lines. In olden times, you'd wander down to Mom's Cafe for a bite to eat and a cup of Joe, and you would feel right at home. It worked just fine, and you never left your hometown. But if you went to the next town over, everyone would look up and stare at you when you came in the door, and the blue plate special would be something you didn't recognize. If you did enough traveling, you'd never feel at home anywhere. But when a businessman from New Jersey goes to I'm not sure where this place is. I think it's like a place he made up. He knows he can walk into a McDonald's and no one will stare at him. He can order without having to look at the menu, and the food will always taste the same. McDonald's is home, condensed into a three-ring binder and Xeroxed. No surprises is the motto of the franchise ghetto. It's good housekeeping seal, subliminally blazoned on every sign and logo that make up the curves and grids of light that outline the basin." And it goes on and on and on. It talks about taking comfort and how America is the world's most surprising and terrible country, and talks about people have, I do like this. They have fled from the true America, the America of atomic bombs, scalpings, hip hop, chaos theory, cement overshoes, snake handlers, spree killers, spacewalks, buffalo jumps, drive-bys, cruise missiles, Sherman's March, gridlock, motorcycle gangs, and bungee jumping. And it says they have parallel parked their bimbo boxes and identical computer design burb clave street patterns and secreted themselves in symmetrical sheetrock shitholes with vinyl floors and ill-fitting woodworks and no side hot walks, vast house farms out in the log low wilderness, a culture medium for a medium culture.
I love that last line. I also love the concept of log low.
Absolutely. Which is, logo glow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's basically this idea, which is very much true, at least in my area, that like you don't really need streetlights because every single store has a giant fucking sign. And so like you just get this basically this river of very chintzy, corny light. That's all these, you know, cornball retail stores just blasting light up into the heavens 24/7, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's you know, it's in that sort of Wild West era of the internet, you know, like we're only a few years out from Buffy, you know, that one episode where we have the demon who's in the internet who can do anything in the world, right? You know, that sort of shit. Like, it's in that sort of Wild West setting, and yet we're kind of at a point where there's no frontier, right? Where everything has been, you know, demarcated and bought up by various interests. You know, I mean, the bit about expanding to your property line is important to us here, right? Because it's something that Neal Stephenson points out earlier, that there's only a very few people who really have the capital to interact with the metaverse, right? And that's essentially what we're dealing with here. I kind of read the suburb stuff as like the ultimate conclusion of the illogical conclusion of NIMBYism, right? You know, that your neighborhood is this corporate entity that has its own, you know, siloed off you know, utilities, its own like borders, you know, its own laws essentially, and
guarded by dogs stolen from poor girls that get turned into robot monsters.
Yes.
I know that we'll get to that, but I fucking tear up.
Oh my
at that
God,
part at the
dude.
End that was like, oh, god yeah. Damn, that was, I have to say, that's like
RIP to a real one.
He doesn't seem like the kind of author who would pull on your heartstrings, but he fucking grabs them, man. The other thing that I think, yeah, like what you were saying about like the nature of the Burv Claves and kind of the way that it's very much like in you are not a citizen of a community in this world. You are a consumer.
You're a customer
of you are a customer of your community, which I think is very perceptive. And also, again, one of those funny, like, it's not a political stance, but it is an ideological stance, but it's also like an aesthetic stance. Like, the worst thing you can be is a consumer. You don't want to be a consumer. Mm-hmm. You need to buy stuff, but you never want to be a consumer. And I think that this book is very much looking down on people who have allowed their environment to become just something that they purchase and don't really live there. They're just kind of, you know, They're just paying for it and biding their time effectively.
Absolutely.
And once you're there, you know, you can just silo yourself off and essentially just, you know, never exist. I mean, that's the blessing and the curse of the United States, right? Is that you can live your whole life in a very small area and never learn another language, right? And, you know, this is that times 10, right? Which, again, you know, that's how New South Africa appears, right? You have these communities that can completely just like arm up and just, you know, defend their reactionary way of life to the death and be completely insulated in that.
And it's interesting too, because like you point out, Kurt, like he there is like an element of like looking down, obviously, because it's like, oh yeah, you go into your McDonald's and driving your bimbo boxes and whatever, and it's like, but like, so is everybody. Like there isn't really an escape from it, and there isn't really an escape, because like, okay, Hero doesn't live in a burb clave, he can't afford to. But he does go on the street, and like, which is like, he does go on the metaverse, the street in the metaverse, and he is a big wheel there. But at the end of the day, like, he's consuming the same trash, and he's working, he has to work in the same system and whatever. And this basically, like, it wants you to be like, it's funny. There's like, I don't know if it's just a Christian analogy, but growing up, I always heard the analogy, Christians must be in the world, but not of the world.
Oh yeah.
I got
yeah.
told that a lot yes, as a kid dude, in yes. church. And I think that is like this too. This is a not Christian, but like, we should be in the world, and we should be in capitalism, and we should be in consumerism, and we should see it all, but we shouldn't be of it. We should be either above it, or more notably, slipping in the little cracks around it, really.
It's very while you were having premarital sex, I studied the Blade.
Literally.
It has a whole lot of that DNA.
Studied the Blade, or indeed, you know, coded the sword fighting in you know, the Black Sun, you know, in the streets.
I have to say that is an ironic bit of humor that I didn't pick up until this reread, is that like, when we, you know, we are shown early on that he is the world's greatest sword fighter in the metaverse, and it's immediately pointed out, but like, well, when you worked for the metaverse company, you wrote the sword fighting, which kind of suggests that like he's cheating. But then later, and it's this open question of like, well, is he actually any good at sword fighting? And later on, he actually does sword fight, and you go, oh, okay, he actually does seem to know what he's doing. But like, early on, it's very much introduced as like, is this guy full of shit also?
It is funny, because most people, though, when he pulls out a sword, they're just like, what the fuck, man? Like, it's like, It is like it's a post-apocalyptic world, but he still does get like the side eye of like, oh, this guy's weird. Like he just happens to run with even weirder people. And because this is the world of like individuals who are prime movers, the weird people really are making the world move, and the not weird people, quote unquote, are sitting behind their desks. And there's another, you know, we mentioned her earlier. There's YT, and she's the other real protagonist of the book. I mean, we talked about her, but she's a courier. She's 15 years old. She's making money because her mom doesn't make a lot of money. Her mom works the most boring job you can possibly conceive, working for the American government out of a sense of duty. We spend time in her job just to see like how she lives, and it is just the most sterile, horrifying corporate environment you can
Doesn't
conceive of.
she work like calculating like toilet paper roll usage,
Or
I
she
think
doesn't
is.
calculate toilet paper roll usage, but she has to read a memo about toilet paper
Oh,
roll
that's right.
usage.
Yes.
And she's
Yes.
only allowed, and they record how long she reads it for. And it's a memo that if she reads in less than 15 minutes, they'll say she didn't pay attention. And if she reads in more than 17 and a half minutes, they'll say she's slow.
And if she reads at the precise calculated pace, she's considered a smart ass and flagged for like further scrutiny.
And it's about how they do toilet paper at the
That's
office.
right. Thank you. Yes. And critically, yes, she works for the government, but later on the president appears, and the president is just like a guy who's trying to get people to notice him in
Yeah,
a
no one
like
recognizes him. That's
and
awesome.
he yeah like he introduces himself, and he says like, "I'm the president," and they go like, "The president of what?" And he goes, the United States."
Yeah. There is a lot of this doesn't lend itself to great to a film adaptation, but that is a scene that that's perfectly timed for like a filmed comedic beat. You
Oh, about YT, critically, she lives her family. I think she's it's just her and her mom,
Yeah,
I
right.
think.
Her, their dad
And
left them
that's
unspecified.
right. And her mom has no idea. Her mom kind of thinks that she's just like a regular 15-year-old girl who's, like stereotypical like 90s clueless type style. And she hides all of her like courier gear like up in like the ceiling of a bathroom where she goes to change. So
I
like
think her mom knows more than she lets on, but it doesn't really matter to the
Right.
plot very much. But like at least in YT's mind, that's the situation that's going on. And YT, she delivers. I mean, they don't have a postal service anymore. So you hire this, like, I mean, we talked about this skating thing, and that's what YT does. And she ends up just because she does that favor of the mafia for the mafia of delivering that pizza, and because she's, I don't know, got spunk and moxie and all those other words that like a mafia boss likes to use. Uncle Enzo, the head of the mafia, is like, this girl kicks ass. I like her a lot. And then he like talks with her, and he's just like, oh wow, I need someone like this to like basically be his like protege. Like it's a little unclear exactly why he's like so into her, but he's just like, she's cool and she's got like, she's innovative and she's interesting. And he's like kind of this older man, Uncle Enzo, who's like one of the big power players in the world because the mafia is now just a completely legal organization. And so he becomes sort of like one of these moving figures in the world. He's one of the big powers in the world. You have another power in the world, which is basically like the Greater Hong Kong, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, with its whole security apparatus. Which like we meet like a lot of strange, figures in that, and they kind of have like an uneasy alliance. And then there's like really a third power in the world that I find to be the most interesting. It's the antagonistic part of the book. We referred to it earlier. It's L. Bob Reif, who like he basically controls the like wires that move the metaverse around. He funds like just a super radical strain of Pentecostalism. And
I
yeah,
mean,
he's basically the
it's basically
Antichrist.
if L. Ron Hubbard met like, Elon Musk or one of these other billionaire
Elon
technocrats, right?
Hubbard.
Yeah,
He's kind of
exactly.
like a Ted Turner figure, I think,
Sure.
is probably a big cultural touch point given the time that this was written. Because that was
The
very much
telecon, yeah.
like, yeah. Because you're exactly right. He's specifically he's like a telecommunications guy, I believe.
Yes.
And credit where credit is due. I think Stevenson picks up very early on the power of owning platforms, which is something that cyberpunk didn't like. Cyberpunk tended to view the internet as a public utility. And
Right.
there's still a lot of that in here. But in 2023, this book is a lot closer to the reality, where it's like a detente between a bunch of corporations, and the government really doesn't have any power over the internet. What really matters is all these weird rich people, you know, trying to leverage their ownership of it. And Stevenson is pretty perceptive of, like, it doesn't matter who is popular on the internet. It matters who owns the wires that it goes through.
Yeah. Right. And notably, most fiction that deals with this kind of thing, for obvious reasons, doesn't care who owns the wires.
Right.
Because 99% of authors, that would be boring as hell to write about. Like, it just doesn't sound interesting. Okay, who owns the wires? But Stevenson not only sees that that's important, but he is good enough at writing. He's got enough adrenaline behind his pen that, like, I'm down for the ride while he describes how L. Bob Reif is related to, like, running this global system. Mm-hmm. And he walks this line of sometimes he's just going to be hyper detailed and he's going to give you every detail about this, like, billboard. And sometimes he's going to generalize and say, yeah, that's the company that runs all of that. Get roll with it. And it's like, it's fun and well-paced and energetic enough that, like, I roll with it. I had, like, a little bit of issue, like, in the, like, maybe like a little in towards the middle, but, like, at the very beginning and the very end, I'm like, I'm all in with this. I'm rolling with it.
Towards the middle, there is a lot of info dumping where Hero's just talking to an AI basically about the inner workings of language and linguistics.
I actually think that part's kind of cool. I didn't mean that.
Well, I mean, you know, the mythology of it is certainly pretty cool. You know, the exposition execution of it is, you know, your mileage may vary, but it gets at what's very critical to the core of this book, which is that the people who, you know, Curtis, you said the people who control the platforms are very important. In particular, the people who know how they work and who can build backdoors into them and who can read the binary and manipulate it accordingly. Mm-hmm. You know, which is exactly what Hero does. You know, he was one of the people who helped build the earliest institutions in the metaverse, in particular the Black Sun Club, mm-hmm. which he had an ownership stake in until shortly before the book started.
Listener, yeah, and you might. Oh, go ahead, Kurt.
I'll just say there's a really interesting contrast between the idea of, again, this trips me out that it's from 1992, because the internet, like, the modern internet really, like, I think that the web was open to the public in 92 or 91, maybe 93. I know that. Are you too familiar with the Eternal September?
I wasn't born when this book came out, so
there's this.
I don't know, okay, what that is.
So there's an early forum service. Well, it's not really an early forum service. It's a middle period forum service called Usenet, which people are still kind of familiar with. It's still kind of around, but was mostly taken down actually because it was being used to trade child pornography. Actually, it was the main reason that it was that it went away. But Usenet was basically like a kind of halfway between a bulletin board and a modern internet forum. And it kind of worked through a system sort of like email, essentially. And what would happen is every September, it would get really shitty because all the new students would arrive at college and get on the internet for the first time and start posting like assholes and shitting it up. And then in 1993, America Online added Usenet, and it was called the Eternal September because all of a sudden all the stupid AOL people were on Usenet, and from the point of view of the internet users of the time, ruined it forever. And that was the end of the elite technocrat internet, when you had to know computers to be on the internet. And I think that Stevenson is really touching on that transition between, like, the early programmer driven internet of David and Hero and the Black Sun, and the later corporate suburban internet of L. Bob Reif, YT's mom, the suburban people, you know, the people who just show up on the street, like, on the weekends in their, like, prefab avatars, basically.
Yes.
And I think he's very perceptive to be drawing that distinction, because I think it's an important one, and it's really central, I think, to the way that this book sees the world, which is, like, Hero is kind of like a dying breed. And I think that part of what Hero wants and part of what Stevenson personally wants is for those people to get back in charge and to knock down the IBMs and the L. Bob Reifs.
Or at least be recognized. I hadn't heard Eternal September, but the concept is familiar to me because 4chan had basically the same thing, right? Mm. They would say, you know, when people posted that, like, didn't know the etiquette or whatever, or that just, you know, came across as like immature assholes, you know, people would be like, oh, it sure is summer in here, you know, implying that, yeah, you know, the kids are off school.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Each new wave of newbies needs more newbies to look down upon.
Yes.
And be like, well, yes, I exactly learned, and now these new guys, they're way worse than even me.
So. Mm-hmm. But now that we're all on the internet, who's the newbies? It's unclear. And I think that's part of why, like, Hero, if he was real, would hate the modern internet in a lot of ways, and would hate this, like, concept of, like, okay, there's a few sites you go to. You don't go to as many distinct sites. Mm-hmm. And I also, like, want to make the point of, like, to the listener, if it sounds like we're doing a really bad job at plot summary, there's just a lot of, like, things happening in this book. Like, it's
the overall plot sounds insane when you
absolutely
explain it too.
And
like,
it is insane.
I could give you like a 1 minute nut of here's the plot of the book, and it'll sound insane.
Honestly, Kurt, you should do that. I want to hear you do it. If you want to go for a 1 minute nut of the, I think that would be fun.
Sure. So it is. So Snow Crash is about the world's greatest hacker and sword fighter, and arguably the world's greatest skateboard courier, uncovering a global corporate conspiracy to install DRM, which was extracted from a linguistic virus from ancient Sumeria that arrived on Earth from space, to install intellectual DRM into the minds of the world's programmers so that you can't remember stuff that happens at work anymore. And it also involves immigration and a Pentecostal religious cult.